Thank you all for coming this morning to session 201. This is intellectual property legislation and litigation update. So hopefully that's all what you want to be here for. My name is Heather Briston. I am the current chair of SAA Council's Intellectual Property Working Group, and I want to thank you for coming this morning. We have three esteemed speakers today that I'm going to introduce, and I'm going to introduce a little bit about what they'll be speaking. Each of them are going to speak for approximately 20 minutes, and we will hold all of the questions until the end. This presentation is being recorded, so when we do the questions at the end, please allow us time to repeat your questions so that it can be recorded. Thank you. Our first speaker is Peter Yazzie from American University Washington College of Law. He teaches domestic and international copyright law, directs the Glushko Samuelson Intellectual Property Law Clinic, and writes about copyright history and theory. He has co-authored and edited several books on copyright law and related topics. Professor Yazzie was a member of the Librarian of Congress's Advisory Commission on Copyright Registration and Deposit, and he was an organizer of the Digital Future Coalition. He is a trustee of the Copyright Society of the United States of America and a member of the editorial board of its journal. He has been working with Professor Patricia Ofterhide of the American University Center for Social Media on projects designed to promote the understanding of fair use by documentary filmmakers and other creators. He has received awards and recognizing his intellectual property work from ALA and the intellectual property section of the District of Columbia Bar. For the years 2009 to 2011, he is also serving as the intellectual property scholar for the Center for Intellectual Property at the University of Maryland University College. Next to him is William Maher. He is the university archivist and professor of library administration at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. He is a past president and treasurer of the Society of American Archivists and a current member of its working group on intellectual property. As the author of one book and over 20 articles, he is a regular speaker on archival administration and copyright. And I think most significantly, he has taught over 400 students, and I don't know, after this last week, probably even more students in SAA's workshop on copyright, the archivist, and the law since 2000. So what we are looking at today in this panel, the working group last presented a legislation and litigation update for intellectual property in 2007. Possibly good. Archives has not been prominent in the courts over the last few years. In some cases, people may think it is good. In some cases, we would like to have a little bit more concrete decisions related to our activities. The legislative agenda has also been limited. Despite of all of that, there are still lots of issues for archivists to be tracking upon. Intellectual property is constantly being refined. So things that we as a profession thought 10 years ago may be slightly different today. Today, the topics that our speakers are going to cover will include fair use, best practices, a discussion of some of the legislative discussions regarding Section 108 and orphaned works, and the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. We're also looking at the traditional cultural expression, and then we will wrap up with a discussion of current cases either currently being litigated or recently decided. Thank you very much.
Peter. Thank you. Well, Heather, thank you for that extremely generous
probably over-generous introduction. I don't feel especially esteemed this morning, but having walked from my car to get here, I feel steamed, thanks to the climate that you've all chosen to share with us this August. But you should feel esteemed because it's the first time this summer I've worn a necktie, and I start teaching next week, so I'm trying to get back into harness. I'm going to be a little contrarian this morning, and I'm going to begin at least by not talking about either of the main headings in the session title, which are legislation and litigation. I'll have a little to say about legislation at the end of my remarks, and my colleagues will have a lot to say about litigation. But I want to talk a little with you this morning about where I think the action is in intellectual property with respect to the issues that I care most about, which are issues that have to do with fair use and the other limitations and exceptions that benefit users, creators, cultural institutions in the Copyright Act. And I don't think that action right now is either in the courts, although they are playing a very important background role, to be sure, or in particular, perhaps unfortunately, perhaps fortunately, in the Congress. It's elsewhere. It's in the civil society. It's, of all places, in the United States Copyright Office, not known as a hotbed of progressive activism in this area. And it is perhaps to a little lesser extent in the international domain, which we'll be hearing more about when we get to the discussion of TCEs, but about which I will, if time permits, say a few words at the conclusion of my remarks. So what do I mean that some of the important action in this area is in the civil society? Well, what I'm referring to in particular is work that, as Heather indicated, I've been doing for the last 5 years with wonderful colleagues, particularly Pat Ofterheide, my colleague at American University. 5 years come November from the formal, visible beginning of the Best Practices in Fair Use project that we and many others have been working on. A little bit of background theory. And by the way, you can find out more than you want to know about Fair Use Best Practices at several websites, of which the most conveniently remembered is probably Center for Social Media, one word, .org. What you'll see if you go to that site is a record of this half decade of work and some indication of the theoretical underpinnings of it, which are simple but worth stating, and that is that a longitudinal historical analysis of fair use case law in the United States from the earliest times to the present day indicates that when practice communities, user communities, communities of creators or other cultural contributors have gotten together, have clearly articulated their own views about what is reasonable and appropriate in the unlicensed use of third-party copyrighted materials, courts are very interested in that information and often defer to it. So the underlying premise of the Best Practices Project is simple, and that is that if communities can come together and state with one voice their consensus positions on what constitutes fair use in their field with appropriate support and documentation, that will not only provide them with useful guidance going forward about what is and isn't good or safe to do, but it will also, in the event, which is relatively unlikely but nevertheless has to be provided for, of litigation, prove influential on the decision maker. And so that's the principle, and we didn't make that up. The credit for that primary insight about the importance of customary consensus, if you can put it that way, best practices, as we phrase it, to copyright fair use really belongs to Professor Mike Madison of the University of Pittsburgh, and he should receive full credit for it. That's the theory. What's the implementation? Well, the implementation essentially involves getting communities to document the areas in which their practice runs up against constraints in the copyright clearance process, and then to articulate those shared values, those best practices, which can then be widely publicized both within and outside the community. And we've been doing this over the last 5 years with a whole series of groups, and in most cases at least, the effects of this have been, if I may borrow a phrase from fair use jurisprudence, transformative. We started with documentary filmmakers. Their best practices were announced in November 5 years ago, and the effect of that set of best practices on the field has simply been, I don't want to say transformative again, so I will say revolutionary. And documentary filmmakers are doing with courage and confidence a variety of things which they either forewent in the past or did only surreptitiously, and they're not getting into any trouble. We've worked with a variety of other communities, online video makers, K through 12 media education teachers and students, various learned societies in both media and communications. Currently, we have two projects underway. One will, I think, see the light early in 2012, and that is going to be a code of best practices for fair use in poetry. And the other is a longer-term project, which some of you may have heard Brandon Butler from ARL talk about a little bit yesterday, and which I'll simply describe and can answer more questions about later if there is interest, and that is the work that we have begun to do with generous support from the Mellon Foundation on a code of best practices for fair use for research libraries. That's a 3-year project which is now underway and which we hope will produce a result sometime in late 2012 or early 2013. There are other projects of this kind underway, some of which we're involved in, some of which we're not involved in art history, in various music-related disciplines and the like. The closest the best practices work has come to the archival community is the work that we helped the Dance Heritage Coalition do on copyright issues in dance archiving. And you can find that material at the website, centerforsocialmedia.org, along with all of the other codes of best practices. And the Dance Archivist's Code of Best Practices, which is proving very influential in that small but important field of archival activity, is, I think, at least interesting as a possible, I don't want to say model, I don't want to say template, I want to say a kind of leading indicator of what it is that the archival community itself might be able to do in articulating fair use best practices for itself on a larger scale. Now, what's cool about this model, apart from the fact that it really seems to work, that it really seems to liberate creative energy, that it really seems to give people confidence to do that which, as a matter of fact, they have always been entitled to do, in addition to the fact that by exercising the muscles of fair use, these communities are making sure that those muscles don't atrophy. I think there are two things that I would say are particularly sort of elegant, if I may use that word, about this model from my point of view. One is that it doesn't require any outside help. This is something that communities of practice can do for themselves. You don't have to wait for the courts to eventually frame and eventually decide, you hope in a favorable way, your test case, which of course in many instances where fair use is concerned will never happen. And you don't have to wait around for Congress, that most unreliable of institutions, to legislate, indeed, at least from the standpoint of some of us, the last thing we actually want to do is to see Congress reopen Section 107 and rethink fair use, because it works pretty well, all things considered, if you take advantage of it. So that's one neat thing about fair use best practices, which is that you can do it yourself. You don't need help. You don't have to wait for some other authority figure to give you permission to proceed. And the other thing, and this is something we'll hear more about, I think, when we get to the litigation survey later in the program, is that the work that we're doing in best practices is very, very closely correlated, as it turns out, with developments in the courts. Because all of the practice communities that we're talking about, to one degree or another, can and do claim that the things they do with third-party materials, the clips that the documentary filmmakers incorporate into their movies, the samples that the film teachers want to employ in the classroom to demonstrate filmmaking technique and so on and so forth, all of these communities of practice understand and are good at articulating the ways in which these practices are transformative, not now in the loose sense of the word, but in the technical legal sense, in the sense that they repurpose existing copyrighted material for a new audience and a new objective. So best practices are nice because they sort of slot into the direction in which the case law is clearly going, and, as I say, because they're something you can do at home without outside assistance. Okay. Now, I said earlier that the next area in which there's action is a very unlikely one. Over all of this fair use stuff, whether we're talking about it in the context of best practices or whether we're talking about it in the context of the evolving jurisprudence of transformativeness, over all of it falls a shadow. And the shadow is, of course, the anti-circumvention provisions of the 1998 Digital Millennium Copyright Act, and in particular, the 1201A1 prohibition against unauthorized circumvention, hacking, code breaking, decryption for purposes of gaining access to copyrighted works which you aren't otherwise authorized to access. Why is this a problem? Well, it's a problem because when the Congress wrote these very industry-friendly provisions back in 1998, they didn't provide a full repertoire of limitations and exceptions to go along with them. There are very few, very narrow, exquisitely crafted limitations and exceptions built into Section 1201, but there's no general fair use exception. There's no general library exception. There's no equivalent to Section 110, and so on and so forth. So use communities look at the scheme and they say, well, here are a bunch of things we're allowed to do under copyright law, either because the statute expressly says we can or because we can and wish to interpret Section 107 as permitting them, but we can't do them. Because in order to do them, we would have to get access to encrypted or otherwise electronically protected material, and doing that is an independent wrong in itself. Because this 1201 stuff is not copyright law, as it is sometimes misunderstood to be. It is, as the Senate report on the DMCA aptly put it, para-copyright law. It's another layer of legal protection, new prohibitions, and new penalties that sit on top of copyright. The only arguably hopeful feature in the scheme of Section 1201, as it was enacted in 1998, and this happened as a result of a lot of pushing by sort of civil society, public interest, copyright activists, was that at the very last minute, as a kind of sop, really, to all of these people who were saying, what about fair use? Where does it go in this scheme? The Congress included a procedure that allows the Librarian of Congress, on the advice of the Copyright Office and to a lesser extent of the NTIA, to make every 3 years a rule, a legislative rule, that identifies new previously unspecified exceptions to the 1201A1 circumvention prohibition where the case has been made that that prohibition is somehow getting in the way of otherwise lawful and significant cultural practices. Now, the first few rounds of this rulemaking were pretty disappointed. There is disappointing. There is some technical language in the Section 1201A1 rulemaking provision, which can be interpreted either broadly or narrowly. And the Copyright Office, which has the biggest say as a practical matter in this rulemaking, even though formally it's the librarian who promulgates the rule, the Copyright Office read that language for the first several rounds of rulemaking very, very narrowly. In 2006, there was a small but significant breakthrough, and I'm proud to say that this was as a result of the presentation made by a wonderful film professor, Peter DeCherney, at the University of Pennsylvania, who had some help from the students in my IP law clinic in putting together his case. Peter demonstrated very persuasively that the things he wants to do in the classroom in showing how films work can be done effectively only with high-quality images of the kind that are more and more often available only by ripping DVDs, which are, of course, encrypted using the well-known and much-loved CSS, or content scrambling system. And Peter was so effective in making that presentation that the Copyright Office looked again at its mandate and re-understood the legislative language in a way that made it possible for them to grant film and media professors at the university level an exemption for the ripping of DVDs for classroom use. It seems like a really small thing, but as a shift in the thinking of the Copyright Office about the potential scope of the 1201A1 rulemaking, it was huge. And the result was that in the following round, the round that began in 2009 and finally was completed by the issuance of a rule by the librarian in the Federal Register a couple of weeks ago, the Copyright Office felt the pressure from a whole new group of applicants and dramatically broadened its rules for these, I will say, transformative uses of DVD content. So now there's an exception not just for film studies professors, but for all university-level professors who want to use film in their classes. There's an exception for students as well as teachers in media education at the university level. There's an exception for documentary filmmakers. There is, remarkably, an exception for individual non-commercial video makers, the people who make the kinds of things that show up on YouTube and other platforms and so forth. Now, there are other interesting things about the ruling. My time is limited, so I'm not going to mention them now, although I'm happy to go into them in questions. The one thing I do want to say is that in addition to everything else that makes this new ruling, which I urge you to look at, easy to find at the Copyright Office website, I've blogged about it a little bit too, and you can find that if it would be of any use. What's interesting about this ruling is that it provides future applicants with a blueprint of what they have to do to get an exemption of their own. And I would urge the archival community to think seriously now about whether it should not be part of the next round, which is actually going to begin, given how long the last round took, very, very soon. Well, that leaves me with my little discussion of legislation and about 30 seconds, and that's very appropriate because nothing's happening, or at least nothing of any interest. Now, this can be a good thing, depending on your point of view, or a bad thing. My view is that it's a good thing, by and large, that the Congress has not chosen to open up and reconsider Section 107. I even think it's probably a good thing on balance that the Section 108 report recommendations haven't gone anywhere because, frankly, I fear what would happen in Congress were Section 108 to be reopened. It's not such a good thing that orphan works legislation continues to languish. The only bright, potentially bright light there is that one hears consistent rumblings from the Senate Judiciary Committee that maybe in the next session the legislation that was formerly and perhaps will continue to be entitled the Sean Bentley Act, which basically limits the liability of users of orphan works who have engaged in due diligence prior to use, that maybe the Judiciary Committee will bring it up again. What is missing at the moment is significant support in the House of Representatives for that legislation. So I'd urge you in this coming political season, the next few critical, crazy months when people are out asking for our votes as individuals and our support as organizations, to remind your congresspeople or your would-be congresspeople that there is such a thing as an orphan works problem and that it ought to be addressed in the next Congress. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Peter. That was quite interesting. Lots of questions for you there. And thanks, Heather, for the generous introduction. I'm going to talk about two areas that are on the horizon that we need to be monitoring, and largely from a quasi or actual international perspective, but has definite playouts in the U.S. context. These are traditional cultural expressions and the anti-counterfeiting, what's the T there?
Trade
agreement.
Improbably enough.
Improbably enough, yes. Let's talk a little bit about the context here first. I think both of these are good windows into a general circumstance that archivists, if they look back at their longer history in relationship to copyright, are characteristic of that history, these trends which we've seen at least since 1976. And what we have is an illustration of how some general things going on in copyright can or may have an effect on us. It's hard to tell yet, but that's why we need to be monitoring them. Number one is, I mean, if you go back to 1710 with the institution of the first copyright bill in England, where you had a fairly limited scope of what copyright was going to be covering, and then our first law in 1790 covering books, charts, and maps, and now it's expanded to all sorts of things such as photographs, music, sound recordings, audio, visual, and so forth. And there's been, so that you have this progression of expansion, there's also a progression of the extent of controls over what you can and cannot do with copyrighted material. And both TCEs and ACTA represent a potential further expansion of what would be covered by intellectual property law and limitations on what can be done, as well as the consequences that you might face, the enforcement mechanisms. And at the same time, the other thing that these two trends show is the impact of globalization or international matters on what U.S. law does, despite the fact that there's this strange effect we can see very clearly with ACTA, where it seems that the U.S. is a driver in exporting a notion of intellectual property, which then is going to come back and need to be overriding American law. And the other aspect, of course, is technological innovations. There's an awful lot of stuff that we wouldn't be talking about copyright if there weren't technological changes, such as the ability to record sound onto some sort of a medium, the ability to record motion pictures onto some medium other than celluloid and such. And both ACTA and the TCEs are a recognition that there may need to be some kind of controls for material because of the expanding technological means of distribution. Okay, traditional cultural expressions. First off, I want to talk about this in relationship to WIPO, and then I'll get to something that's been going on within ALA. Traditional cultural expressions, for short, referred to as TCEs. This is a term of art describing a wide range of, quote, things, close quote, such as stories, myths, folk tales, songs, music, symbols, designs, architectural elements, dances, rituals, and such, of a traditional society or an indigenous people. One of the major problems in this area has been to develop definitions of what a traditional cultural expression is and all of the related elements one would need to have to create a rights structure, that definitions that are precise enough but also inclusive enough so that you don't end up creating implementation problems or problems that bump up against existing rights. International organizations began to show some concern to move forward for some kind of a protection in these areas starting in the 1950s and the 1960s. But there had been a great deal of difficulty in trying to determine what was the best type of protection to come up with for it. In 2000, WIPO, the World Intellectual Property Organization, which establishes and manages and oversees the Berne Treaty, which looks at sets international norms for what national country laws would be, they established the Intergovernmental Committee on Intellectual Property and Genetic Resources, Traditional Knowledge, and Folklore, which they gave the handy acronym, of IGC rather than the full thing. The IGC for simply Intergovernmental Committee, but that's how it is referred. Its goal was to work for some sort of a sui generis protection of traditional cultural expressions and genetic resources. It began its work in 2001, but it kept needing to have its two-year mandates renewed. And if you read the progress reports down to at least at least last winter, they weren't much progress, but there were a lot of reports looking forward to how many people would be participating in the next layer, where they would meet, and whether they would talk about creating a text or talk about principles first and such. However, in the most recent months, in July, a intersessional meeting, and it's important to recognize that that was an intersessional meeting, which was a more selective group than the full IGC, came up with 11 articles that are a very clear step towards development of a text for what could become a legal instrument, in other words, an international treaty that would be put through WIPO, that will be next considered at a meeting in December. The Library Copyright Alliance, which is a basically a U.S. group including the ARL, the ALA, is AALL still in it?
ACRL.
Okay. ACRL, and if you look at the webpage, you'll see the splay of logos of organizations on their head, has issued a statement in July about several of its concerns. The statement was written by Jonathan Band, and it expressed concern about several things: an overly broad scope, the propriety of the fit of international legal norms for the fundamental concerns and nature of materials that were considered as TCEs. These Brand's document noted that created problems for the boundaries of identifying even where the boundaries of the public domain would be. A registry system, which was articulated by the Library Copyright Alliance as potentially impeding intellectual freedom and so forth. And in the question period, I can provide the URL if you want to go look at that. So that's on the horizon. We don't know quite what will happen in December. If you look at the past history for the past 10 years, you would think that it's just going to drag on for a longer period of time. But we do have this last 4 or 5 months in which there have been some sudden movement forward on an agreement on 11 articles of what might go into a treaty on TCEs. somewhat in parallel or in anticipation that eventually something was going to come out of WIPO on TCEs, the ALA's Office of Information Technology Policy anticipated that it might need to provide advice on a how the library community in the United States would respond to anything that came out of WIPO. And so it set up a group in 2008 with a meeting in Washington to begin developing a statement on traditional cultural expressions. Its statement went through a number of different drafts and finally by the end of 2009 had reached draft number six, if I have it right, which they were putting forward to ALA Council for adoption, to request adoption. Several organizations, including SAA in the person of Peter Gottlieb, our president, as well as RBMS, came forward to voice concerns about things that were stated in the draft six of the American Library Community proposed statement on TCEs. And as a result of this, this level of concern that was put forward, the ALA Council did not adopt it, but instead established a new task force, a special task force that was going to have a broader level of representation to come up with a revision of that and to work closely with CALM, the Committee on Library, Joint Committee on Library, Museums, and Archives, Archives, Libraries, and Museums, to develop a new draft. I understand that Christian DuPont, who is a member of the ALA task force, as well as Fred Stilo, are in the audience, and they could probably provide us with an update. This task group, as I understand it, was given a mandate to come up with a revised version. I guess it would be version 7 or version 8. There is a version 7 out there now on the OITP's website. To have that for action by ALA Council at midwinter 2011, so a few months from now. Okay, changing gears. The Anti-Counterfeiting Trade Agreement, ACTA. In October 2007, the United States, the European Union, Switzerland, and Japan indicated that they would want to negotiate a new intellectual property enforcement treaty, a treaty that would define how enforcement would be done to deal with infringements of intellectual property. Subsequently, that group has been joined by a number of other countries, including Mexico, Australia, Korea, New Zealand, Jordan, Morocco, Singapore, United Arab Emirates, and Canada. And there have been a series of negotiations that have been held in secret, and the things that have been announced from ACTA have been that whatever we do is not going to require a change in legislation. But there have been other leaks from some of the parties involved to suggest that, well, yes, some changes in legislation really would be necessary if this provision or that provision were incorporated. And this has kind of became quite out in the open and clear that there was this disparity. Late winter, there was a draft of the ACTA agreement that was leaked, and in that agreement there were several sections of bracketed text, and what the bracketed text indicated were areas, provisions of the enforcement mechanisms that were being proposed, which would necessitate changes in legislation in one country or another, or one country or another which would not necessarily be able to adopt that provision without a change in its legislation, so thus kind of giving lie to that. And finally, in April, a version of the agreement, an official version of the agreement, was released with the change that while the sections of the text were still bracketed, those provisions which were not yet agreed to by all parties, but the countries to which could not agree to those particular provisions were stripped from the document. Okay, So again, the Library Copyright Alliance has provided a very useful analysis of this, and they identified a number of issues which I think are why we need to keep our eyes on this and from the archival area. Number one, these were problems in relation to U.S. implementation, problems that would effectively, if ACTA were to be adopted and put into legislation being a treaty that we would agree to, then it could have the effect of overriding and limiting what we could do in legislation. Number one, depending on the way the final language comes out, in statutory damages, which are a key part of how copyright operates and how as an economic system in this country, and serve as basically a balancing force, because courts have a certain amount of discretion as to how much of a statutory damage they can award in a case, depending on the willfulness or the innocentness of the infringement and the circumstances involved. Libraries and nonprofit institutions have a certain safe harbor there, that if they had a reasonable ground for making a fair use in having made a copy, that they would be exempt from statutory damages. And the ACTA terms could take that away and require any participating country in ACTA to have a specific set of damages that's set. They're probably less of immediate concern for us has to do with the exposure that U.S. companies might face because of reduced availability of a fair use defense, also the lack of the kind of safe harbor that ISPs have been available in the United States the safe harbor that U.S. ISPs have against claims of contributory infringement as a result of the changes that were put into the DMCA. The anti-circumvention provisions that we have, as limited as they are, Peter was talking about them earlier, in sections 1201D through J, would be made optional in countries' laws. And again, insofar as they were retained within our laws and within our country, it would probably be okay. But one never knows. As Peter says, hey, sometimes it's a lot better if Congress doesn't do any legislation. And doing nothing sometimes is doing good. They start tampering with the section, then who knows what will happen. Another particular concern that the Library Copyright Alliance had was the wide extent to which ACTA used freely and rhetorically the labels of piracy and pirating. While all of us have probably heard this in the media and heard various congressional testimony on the part of motion picture industry in particular and the music industry of the reference to piracy, it is not a term which appears anywhere in the U.S. statute, and I don't think it truly appears very much at all in court opinions and court judgments, although it may be in the testimonies and the pleadings on one side or the other. We refer to infringement. And infringement can be defined as an individual copy or distributing a copy or making derivative works and doing all those kinds of things. But it is this whole approach which takes a very much an anti-user attitude towards what happens with copyrighted material that ACTA is premised on. That is, you know, one can understand the notion of having a treaty that would agree to enforcement principles, but when the enforcement principles include provisions that speak to specific balancing and safe harbors that we have in our law, then what we have is a situation where the United States is effectively trying, as the Library Copyright Alliance pointed out, is trying to export all of the enforcement mechanisms and the rigor of American copyright law, but none of the protections. And I will leave it at that and let you worry about those dark things going on in the background, maybe.
Wow. Well, another big thank you to all three of our speakers today. And we're now at the point where we're hoping that you have lots of excellent questions for our panelists. And what I'll do is I will repeat the question for our people who are taping it. So please let me know if I have mischaracterized. You're going to need those. If I've mischaracterized your question, please do let me know. So we've got a question already.
I just want to follow up on the last statement Peter made. My response to that, he and I have not seen eye to eye fully on those principles, but my response is if you're going to look to those principles, you start with getting Peter's book and reading it from cover to cover and use it religiously.
Hear, hear. Yes, very good. We've begun to call it the well-intentioned, well-informed practices. Now, I saw a question right here in the middle. The question is, where can we go to find more information about best practices in the art history realm according to fair use?
I don't know for sure what public resources are available, but I'd suggest starting with the College Art Association.
We've got
there
a question.
Is a group that's just forming in New York City to start working on fair use practices for the use of visual images in art history, but it's a brand new group. There's no schedule for how they're working or what they're doing, but I've been asked to be part of that group, so I'll be reporting on it at some point.
Great. So I think we had a question here and then a question over here. So, yes. Okay, so I'm going to try and summarize that. The information from the floor is that there is a group headed up by the New York Bar Association. Pamela Rutledge?
Virginia
Rutledge is the person that is heading that up, and there should be some information coming around soon. Now, I saw over here a question. Yes, right here.
I can restate the question if you want.
Thank
sure.
You,
the,
Peter.
The question is whether in the Ann Pierce Hawker Smithsonian case, was there a deed of gift, and did it say anything about copyright? There is a deed of gift. I wrote about this on the librarylaw.com blog at blog.librarylaw.com and have posted as well there and on Scribd the actual complaint from Ann Pierce Hawker against the Smithsonian that includes a copy of the deed. And the deed said that she retained copyright in the images and that for any commercial use, the Smithsonian had to contact her and get her permission for commercial uses. So part of her complaint is that the Smithsonian had not followed the terms of the deed. But again, we don't know what their response is going to be on this, so I couldn't say one way or another whether there are other complicating issues or other documents that we don't know about. But it is fun to be able to go attached as appendix the original deed of gift. They then and then the original reproduction form and the reproduction form as it was edited and finalized on that. And it's fun to see an archive, the kind of dirty underbelly being exposed on how we actually do work.
Other questions? Yes. Do you want to characterize the question, or shall I?
Yeah, you know, why don't you go ahead and characterize
okay.
that? And that'll give me a chance to think about it.
All righty. Well, the question is, under libel law, didn't it seem that the Cornell digitization of newspapers case was a spurious case? Isn't truth an absolute defense? And so then for university publications, could you repeat that last bit? So based on that, would it just be the idea for a university just to pull whatever was objected to in order to avoid the suit, when in effect it would probably be something that they could win anyway?
Well, Peter Yazzie can probably confirm whether this is true, but I don't think any lawsuit is ever a slam dunk. There's always some issue that a clever lawyer can bring up and raise, and there were concerns. To start with, have you ever read a journalistic article that is 100% accurate? And in this case, I think I'd have to pull up the exact wording, but it said that he was charged with third-degree burglary in connection with 10 thefts on campus, and in reality, the charge of third-degree burglary was in relation to one specific incident on campus, and then in his questioning before the police admitted to being involved with 10 other incidents on campus, and actual charge. So there were some little, you could read the wording slightly differently. He also pointed out that the records had been sealed the arrest, and so that releasing this newspaper article somehow affected the fact that this was all supposed to be in sealed records. And I thought the most interesting argument and the most dangerous was that by digitizing and making it available on Google, the university was in effect republishing this material, and that as a publisher, we had the same sort of editorial responsibility to sit down and confirm the accuracy of every statement that was in the newspaper. And you can just imagine, how are we, if we had to go back and confirm everything in the 1983 issues of the newspaper. And our lawyers argued very strenuously that this was not a republication. And the courts ignored all of that and just said this falls under California's strategic lawsuit against public participation laws, and that people have an interest in crime on campus, and so we won't talk with those issues, and it got settled that way.
You almost get into freedom of press and expression and, I'd say, burdensome constraints on that.
It does raise issues as you suggest, it raises the issue of freedom of the press and mm-hmm. other things. I'm just very fortunate that I work for an institution that was willing to spend a large amount of legal money in order to defend two sentences in a newspaper as a matter of principle, mm-hmm. and that they thought it was important not to tamper with the historical record if it can be avoided. But that's... your institution might decide, no, we'll just go ahead and take it down and not have to worry about it.
Mm-hmm.
And just a second, everything that Peter has said, it's an extremely important thing that Cornell stood up in this case. The question, I think, raises for me a larger issue relating to the risk management approach to the making decisions about how archival or any other kind of cultural practice is going to be carried forward. Obviously, risk management is essential, but by the same token, it is possible to overdo risk management. It is possible to be too risk averse. So while I think we can all agree that risk management is an essential piece of all of this, there remain a lot of questions about the titration of tolerable risk that will take place within institutions. Sometimes it will come out in a good way, as it did in Cornell, and sometimes it will come out in a bad way, and that may be the situation in which other people in the same institution have to say to their decision makers, to their university council, to their president, to whoever is making these calls, look,
we have rights here, and we are engaged in an important cultural enterprise that depends for its success on the exercise of those rights, and risk management can be carried too far.
I want to follow that up with a question to Peter Hurdle here. How much do you estimate that Cornell had to pay in legal costs?
We were assigned legal fees for the court, and I'd have to run in, for the two initial district defamation suits against us. And my recollection is together they cost about $120,000, and I think the court assigned us about $70,000 of that. We were only asking for our legal fees for the outside law firm that we had to hire in California to represent us, and we even got them at an educational discount. It doesn't include our in-house counsel's time or my time in doing with it, and it doesn't include any of our expenses associated with the appeal to that court. So I would guess, you know, it was probably about $200,000 for those two sentences. But I think the principle is pretty important, don't you?
Okay. I don't have any problem with that. But what the reason I wanted to ask that is this is a good point, because if we are going to play in the field of risk management, then that is the other side of the fence. That is the; those are the consequences that, it, in order to play in records management, I'm sorry, in risk management, it's going to cost us in either settlement costs or legal fees, and so that's one very important reason to be bringing your institutional counsel and other institutional overseers along with the approach you're taking. And, in this instance, I think it was absolutely essential that Cornell did that, because if it took down just this particular article, okay, that's one piece, that's one big hole in the historical record, but the claim threatened the entirety of the newspaper's presence.
Any other questions? Yes, back in the pink shirt there. Well, the question is looking at both the Google case but then also looking at the Cornell student newspaper case. The Google case is looking at questions of authorship and being reimbursed for authorship, whereas the Cornell case is looking at issues of content and libel. And what the person asking the question is asking the panel for is, are there comments on this difference between risk management from the authorship and the funding of that point of view versus the content point of view? Yes.
I think the question may overstate the real extent of the dilemma, thanks to something that Peter made very clear before, and that is that it is almost unheard of to receive a lawsuit without a previous threat or demand. So that as a practical matter, the risk management issue in a case like this arises not when the content is put online, but when the decision is being made as to whether to take that particular content down. And that's a manageable inquiry. I happen to think that Cornell made the right decision to stand up for the principle, given the larger implications of a concession. But by the same token, I can imagine another institution, differently funded or differently inclined, making a different decision. In neither case, audit, as far as I can tell, and I'm not an expert on any of this, but in either case, as far as I can tell, it shouldn't affect initial decisions about what goes up.
I want to follow up on that. I would agree absolutely there that life is not without risk in everything. And everything we do in our archival curatorial responsibilities involves a risk one way or the other, whether it's in the selection of what sort of archival containers we're going to use or environmental conditions. All this, there's risks in all of that. There's risks in every appraisal decision we make. And one of the important the key thing is how we go about managing it. There are various levels here. I do somewhat wonder a little bit what the thinking was as to why maybe Cornell's initial reaction wasn't to take it down until they kind of got their ducks in a row to figure out how they were going to deal with the response, but rather than just keeping it up automatically from the beginning. However, going back to that, as Peter Yahtzee just said, the risk involved in putting the material up in the first place, I think one additional way in which that risk can be managed is that the information you have on the web page or however it is that the user gets to see the content, that information is makes very clear that you're presenting this with the understanding that this is historical material available for research and educational purposes. It is testimony to whatever it says, and the institution's making no claims otherwise, et cetera. You know, appropriate kinds of disclaimer, but especially tied to that archival mission of preservation and accessibility of material for research and further examination. That will then be a factor that will be what we all feel logically as to why, as the point from over here on the side in the prior question, as to why it's there in the first place. That's going to be used in the defense, and that's an important way to manage the risk.
And, you know, thinking about the Google example, I hope Google's got a really good archivist, because someday I would love to know, when they were thinking of their books project, if they ever conceived that they were involved in risk scanning books for indexing purposes. Because what were they saying is that, hey, we're going to make these books easier to find, and we'll put in links maybe to Amazon.com to use bookstores and to libraries so that people will be able to buy these things if they want to. And once they find the book that's of interest to them and want to read the full text, how could anyone object to that? It would only to make your work more discoverable without impacting upon the market for it at all. So I could imagine very easily it would be very interesting to know if they were surprised when the Authors Guild suit and the AAP Guild suit came forward, and they didn't anticipate the kind of anger of the authors. And I have no idea whether that's the case. Yep. The question was the initial plan to start with out-of-copyright titles? And Microsoft did that with their book scanning project. But Google, from the start, was doing both in-copyright and out-of-copyright. It made it very easy to do it efficiently. They could just take entire shelves from the Michigan and California and Stanford libraries and digitize them without having to select.
Okay, we've got time for about one more question. Anybody? All right, I don't see any more hands, so thank you again all very much.